Hi, I'm Michael Feinstein. My guests today are Herb Alpert and Lonnie Hall. Herb is a world-renowned musician, composer, producer, and co-founder of A&M Records, the largest independent record label in history. He rose to fame with the Tijuana Brass and is the only artist to have a number one record both as a singer and as an instrumentalist. His many honors include 7 Grammys and the Trustees Grammy Award, along with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Lifetime Achievement Award. Lonnie Hall is the original lead singer of Sergio Mendez's group, Brazil 66. They met when the group signed with A&M Records and began a love story and a musical journey. Lonnie went on to her own solo career, recording more than 14 solo albums in 3 different languages, winning a Grammy, as well as singing the title song to the James Bond film, Never Say Never Again. Lonnie and Herb, welcome to Song Travels.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Nice to see you.
Thank you for being part of Song Travels. It's wonderful to be able to talk to two people who, between the two of you, embody so much of what I love about the music business. I think something that comes through in both of your work is a certain kind of humanity. Mm. And it's clear to me that you really love music.
Crazy about music. But I got really lucky because when I was 8 years old, they had a music appreciation class in my grammar school.
This is in L.A.?
In L.A. You know, I had this advantage. So I had this music appreciation class that allowed me to pick up a trumpet that was on a table and tried to make sense out of it and, you know, it changed my life. And because of that, you know, I feel like I'd like to pass that on if I can to children that, you know, deserve to explore their creativity.
You're involved in a lot of philanthropy to teach young people music.
Oh, yeah. I believe creativity is a really good way to get life started. You know, you get to explore your own uniqueness. And if you do that and you can appreciate yourself, you know, you might be able to appreciate other people's uniqueness as well.
That's well put. Lonnie, you're from Chicago.
Yes, I am.
When did music begin for you? Or when did it become an integral part of your life?
Oh, I think when I was very young, and when I would sit in the car when my parents would take us places, they'd turn the radio on, I listened to the music and I'd start singing along with it right away. And I got a feeling inside my body when I would sing with music. And life seemed to take on more of a shine when I was exposed to music. And that has always stayed with me.
Do you have a memory of the first song that meant something to you or stuck with you?
Tubby the Tuba.
Ah. Oh, I remember that jazz tune. Didn't Charlie Parker record that?
I loved it.
Tubby the Tuba. George Kleinsinger.
And Judy Garland sang it.
Judy Garland sang it?
That's the album that my parents had. And I just played that all the time, and I just really was a big fan. And I remember that, me singing that song in the middle of our living room all the time. I would sing Tubby the Tuba.
Well, I'd like to ask if you would sing something today, right now. It would be my great pleasure to accompany you at the piano.
Oh, I would love that, Michael.
There's a Cole Porter song that is probably his most famous song. What does Night and Day mean to you?
Well, Night and Day, the first time I sang Night and Day was with Sergio Mendez and Brazil 66, the group.
Yes.
And I knew it, but I'd never sung it before. And I was so struck with that little difference in the melody. And I remember looking at Sergio saying, I don't think that's the right melody. And he said, it is. It's on the sheet music.
Yes. Well, let's give this a whirl and let's see what kind of mood you're in.
Wonderful.
Here's our guest Lonnie Hall performing Night and Day, I'll Be at the Piano.
Night and day. The one, only you beneath the moon and under the sun, whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you night and day. Is it so? This longing for you follows wherever I go. In the roaring traffic's boom, the silence of my lonely room, I think about you night and day. A hungry yearning burning inside of me. This torment won't be through till you let me spend my life making love to you night and day.
A Cole Porter classic, Night and Day, performed by our guest Lonnie Hall, who is here with her husband Herb Alpert. Beautiful, beautiful.
The same to you.
Thank you.
Herb, I enjoyed that too, by the way.
Good. Well, you've been together how many years now?
We've been married 40 years, and we've been together about 44 years.
We met
when I auditioned Sergio Mendes, Brazil 66, in 1966. And Lonnie and I became, friends before anything else happened, and we have a great foundation.
Did you produce Brazil 66?
I produced the first few albums, and Sergio, kind of really turned me on to Brazilian music, which was extraordinary. I was aware of Stan Getz and Girl from Ipanema and Desafinado, but then I didn't realize there was a whole wealth of wonderfully talented young artists in Brazil that were writing songs, not the beat of the week. They were writing, extraordinary melodies. And of course, Jobim was a big daddy because, he had the perfect combination. I think the perfect combination, you might agree with this, that it's if you can write a simple melody with wonderful harmonic structure, you got a good chance of making a song that'll last. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, yes. It's the simplicity which gives it room to be interpreted in many mm-hmm. different ways.
And Jobim really just had that, just a couple notes in the right place.
And people are studying it now, they're doing analysis and going back and I think looking a little too closely sometimes.
Absolutely. Art is a mystery. I think that's what mm-hmm. intrigues me. Sculpting, painting, and making music and dance. If you think too hard about it, you'll miss it. You'll miss the experience. I don't think you can identify. What do you like about a Louis Armstrong solo? Can you nail it? I can't.
It's true. And you, of course, express your art in many different ways. You are a painter and a sculptor.
I get a lot of pleasure out of it. I feel like all three of those arts are pretty similar. I start with a blank canvas. I try not to overthink it, and I try to use my inspiration and my intuition and let it fly. That's what jazz is. I started as a classically trained musician, And then I got corrupted when I heard Miles and Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and all those guys.
Clifford Brown.
You know, I wanted to just close my eyes and play my own music. Because I had an experience. I was playing in an orchestra, and I was in the back row. We were playing Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky that was orchestrated by Ravel.
Ah, yes.
And when the orchestra started playing, man, I was so intrigued with the sound. I was leaning forward, listening to this kind of like a stereophonic sound.
Yes.
And I forgot to come in, you know. Uh-huh. So at that point, I realized, you know, I really don't want to play other people's music. I'd like to see if I can, you know, design my own way of doing it. And that's what, I started pursuing, because there was a moment in my life when I was a little bit of Harry James, a little bit of Rafael Mendez, a little bit of Louis Armstrong, and who want to hear that? I mean, I was a carbon copy of somebody else, so I tried to come up with my own identity, and little by little, I found it.
How long was the process of going from playing in a classical orchestra to learning how to play jazz? I mean, did you literally hear it and say, I want to learn how to, I want to do that, or had you dabbled in it?
No, jazz is a very specific language, and if you think you don't play it just because you know the chords and the tune and you can close your eyes and make notes. There's a certain sound to jazz that you have to work at, and you have to listen to the masters and see how they were interpreting sounds and scales.
Yes, it was all a life experience that was not in
totally,
a school.
Yeah.
What is the experience of working together and making music together?
Oh, it's great. We have a trio behind us, bass, drums, piano, and three not only great musicians, but they're friends of ours. We've been doing concerts for the last 7 years.
Michael Shapiro on drums,
yeah.
Hussein Jiffrey on bass, and Bill Cantos on piano.
Oh, he's great.
He's wonderful.
I know Bill's work. He's
they're all wonderful.
Great arranger, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we do concerts, and we just have a grand old time because, you know, what I'm doing is I'm playing jazz for the most part. You know, each night is a different experience for me with even playing the same songs over and over. It's always like I'm playing it for the first time. And Lonnie kind of establishes the song. And I told the band, I said, you guys just play whatever you want. You know, I'll tell you if it's not working, I'll let you know. And so the drummer, Michael Shapiro, doesn't play the same thing once. You know what I mean? So we have a great time.
Herb, before we do something together in the studio, I'd like to play something from your iconic history, perhaps A Taste of Honey.
Well, A Taste of Honey was a good one for me because it was the first time that I realized that you got a focus group when you're playing, concerts. Taste of Honey was on the B side of the record. The A side was something that was a little more radio friendly, as my partner Jerry Moss thought. You know, it was a third man theme.
Ah,
and it had like was rocking along.
Yeah.
And in concert, every time I played Taste of Honey, people would go crazy. I mean, there was something about it that, you know, they really liked. So I called my partner. We were playing in Seattle, Washington at the time at the Edgewater Inn. And I said, Jerry, I think we're on the wrong side. I think it's Taste of Honey. I mean, the audience has told me. And so, you know, we finally turned that record over, and it became, you know, a big hit. And that was the song that opened the door wide, because The Lonely Bull was a hit, and we had a couple other things, moderate hits. But then when Taste of Honey happened, you know, boy.
You crossed the threshold.
Ed Sullivan.
Oh, there you go. Let's listen to a part of it right now. Herb Alpert and Tijuana Brass.
Thank you.
A Taste of Honey, the famous recording by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. The story about the Tijuana Brass being a studio group and then becoming an actual live performing entity. I wonder how often that has happened in recording history.
Well, I think quite a few times. Because, you know, in the 60s especially, it was about the producer. Huh. You know, you produce a good record, you get the right people, you get the, you know, all the elements together, you got a hit record. Oops, now we got to get a group.
With your relationship together, because you're touring together, so you're working together, does it ever get in the way of your personal life? Do you ever have problems with saying, no business, let's just relax, or that sort of thing?
No, I think it enhances our personal life. We're both artists.
Yeah,
know?
We're both artists, and we both love to create, and we have this language between us that we understand totally because we both know what it takes, the work that it takes, the research that it takes, the memorizing that it takes. We know what all of that is, and it's perfect. It's wonderful. I mean, to work together, Herb said to me in about 2006, he said, is there anything that you haven't done yet that you wanted to do musically? And I said, yeah. There, you know, there's this Nancy Wilson Cannonball Adderley album that I love. Mm-hmm. And I would like to do something like that together. I would like to be the singer, and then you'd be playing jazz, and And so we got this group together, and we started doing that. And I mean, at this point, it just was not fun for me to leave and go on the road and promote an album that I had done and leave all my loved ones. I wasn't happy doing that anymore. And so now I don't have to leave. We go together.
I'd love to do something with you, Herb.
Sure.
Something extemporaneous.
I want you to sit down at the piano and we'll just fool around, see what happens.
Okay. All right. That's not my usual MO, but your calm demeanor and your ingratiating smile.
It's scary for me, too. I pick up the horn. I don't know what's going to happen. I'll respond to what you're doing, and you'll respond to what I'm doing, and see what happens.
Okay, let's go. That was When Sunny Gets Blue. Michael Feinstein here with Herb Alpert. That was sort of like a roller coaster for me. I love that. I have such admiration for your musical mind. It's something that I marvel at when I listen to jazz, to hear how things happen instinctively, but they are so ordered. It's sort of like a snowflake. It's just fascinating.
It's interesting how jazz works. You know, I was listening to a show by Mary McPartlin, rest her soul, who was doing this interview with Bill Evans.
Ah.
And they were playing together. And all of a sudden, Bill started displacing the rhythm. You know, it was like, you know, how he could do it. He could just kind of like go into Nowheresville and then come back. And Marion stopped and said, I think I'm getting vertigo.
That's fun. Oh, what a doll she was.
Yeah.
What a doll. Lonnie, when you were with Brazil 66, you were making recordings that involve multi-tracking that are wonderful to hear. I remember as a kid hearing Les Paul and Mary Ford with those early experiments in multi-tracking. How were those recordings created?
Through the producer. The producer said to Sergio, I mean, did you say, isn't that the story, darling, that you...
Well, there was Lonnie and this other girl that was like more of a model. She was, you know, a beautiful Brazilian girl that, you know, had an okay voice, but it wasn't a recording voice. And when I heard Lonnie's voice, I said, wow, I mean, that'd be nice to double Lonnie's voice and create that environment. And that's what we did.
Is the other girl on the record?
No.
She's on the cover?
She's on the cover. She's on the cover.
God bless
her.
She's
very beautiful. Not as beautiful as Lonnie.
She was wonderful. She's like a sister to me.
Yeah, no, very nice, very nice.
Beautiful.
She wasn't all that happy. That was she wasn't singing.
No, she wasn't happy. She quit the group probably 7-8 months into it.
Oh boy, that's tough.
Yeah,
that's
it was. It was hard. It was hard for the other singers because we established this sound already. And nobody wanted to change it in the recording studio, so it was not comfortable for some of the singers, and I don't blame them. I don't think it would have been comfortable for me either.
Right.
I fell in love with Brazilian music. I mean, I really got into it, and I was just enchanted by it, the richness of the melodies. And the juxtaposition between the melodies and the sophistication and more of the sacredness of these melodies and the primitive quality of the rhythms was such a mix for me. It was like a paradox.
Mm.
And it was just beautiful. I mean, I was completely sold, and then I started writing lyrics to a lot of the Brazilian songs that we recorded, which was something that I didn't even know I was capable of doing. And it just was such an opportunity for me as a singer and an artist to be exposed on that level to such unbelievable music.
Let's listen to at least a portion of your recording with Brazil 66, A Fool on the Hill, mm-hmm. because that's an example of taking the Brazilian sound and creating something
adapting
very
it.
Fresh
yeah.
with Lennon and McCartney,
yeah.
which still is revelatory as we hear it now.
The man of the fire.
The Fool on the Hill, performed by Brasil 66, with our guest Lonnie Hall singing and our other guest Herb Alpert producing. There's more coming up in a moment with Herb and Lonnie. I'm Michael Feinstein, and this is Song Travels from NPR Music. Herb, I'm very curious about the choices that you made when you and Jerry ran A&M Records. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that certainly you had more of an awareness of world music than other labels did. Is that a correct perception?
Well, we had an awareness of not wanting to make or look for the beat of the week. We tried to, you know, find artists that had that little special something, little left of center, you know, the Cat Stevens of the world, the Carpenters, the artists that just came in from left field, and we always felt that we were honored to have this great stable of artists. I mean, it got to the point where, you know, the success kind of was dictating. Artists were calling us, wanting to record for us. I mean, it was beautiful because, you know, I had an experience. I recorded for a major company prior to A&M, and they didn't treat me very well. I was treated like a number. Huh. I was like, you know, 78254. Take one, you know, that type of thing, in this very cold-looking studio that didn't have an environment that I was comfortable in. And then I was listening to a playback of one of the recordings that I did, and I wanted to hear a little more bass, so I went over to the board, and I lifted the bass track up, and the engineer slapped my hand. He says, "Don't ever touch that board again." He says, "This is a union house." And I thought, well, gee whiz, shouldn't the record industry revolve around the artist. And that was like good fodder for me. I mean, it really gave me the idea. I thought if I ever had my own record company, I would certainly put the artist first and make sure that they're comfortable, etc. And that's what we did at A&M. We created studios that felt like a living room, like an environment that you wanted to be in. I bought a big crystal and put it into a studio B, embedded it into the wall, and you know, like artists would come, like Sting, and they'd go in front of this crystal, they'd be davening like they were in front of the Wailing Wall, you know, I guess praying for a good recording session or whatever, you know. So it was like a very, you know, cozy place to be.
A&M nurtured artists.
We were in the artist corner. We felt like if the artist, you know, heard their recordings and they went out and did concerts, you know, they would finally flag themselves down to the runway. They'd hear what the audience would tell them what they want to hear. And that's, for the most part, that's what happened.
And, of course, you purchased the Chaplin Studios, the Chaplin lot.
We did. We bought the studios from CBS, and when we moved in, we had, you know, like a handful of employees. My father, rest his soul, you know, he said, "Well, you really need all this space?" I said, "Well, we'll see. It's going to work out." So, you know, we got lucky. You know, timing plays a big part in it. So, like if we started A&M today, in today's world, in today's environment, with today's computer technology and all that, I think it would be a tougher go. But it was the right time, the right place. And luckily I had a partner that would handle, you know, most of the business side of it, because I'm 85% on the right side of my brain. So, you know, I have pretty good instincts when it comes to people and artists, but when it comes to business, you know, I start yawning.
Right. Well, then I think that's a cue to do something else musically. Let's sidle over by the piano and give it a go. Thank you. Wow, that was Lerner and Lowe. I've grown accustomed to her face.
Love that song. I played it with the Tijuana Brass in the 60s. We were playing actually at Madison Square Garden.
Do you feel that an instrumentalist should know the lyrics of a song?
Absolutely. I'm totally aware of the lyrics when I play a melody. I think you have to be that conscious of it, and it's important that you express the song. I mean, you know, Stan Getz always said, if you can't improve on the song, don't do it, you know? So I'm super conscious of the lyric as I play the melody.
I can hear you play the lyric.
Mm-hmm.
I can hear it.
Yeah, well,
it changes the phrasing, certainly. Now, you have a new CD called In the Mood, and your upcoming tour is one that will be supporting that.
It's called In the Mood, and I'm in the mood. Are you in the mood?
Well, I'm in the mood to listen to one of the cuts from it.
Yeah, you know, there's a cut that I did. It was arranged by Michael Shapiro. I always wanted to record America the Beautiful.
Why?
Well, because of, you know, America is a melting pot. And what we did on this, and Michael, you know, put it together, we have instruments from the seven continents of the world that are playing on this record, you know, from, you know, to some really exotic instruments. And it's, I know you have to hear it. Like, you can't explain it. But the idea that, you know, this is what this country is all about. It's about people
the melting pot.
Coming from all over the world
and making
trying
it
to
home.
Live in harmony.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to it. I'm looking forward to this. Our guest, Herb Alpert, performing America the Beautiful from In the Mood. America the Beautiful in a very fresh and different interpretation.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I thought this was an Irving Berlin song, and it's not. It was a poem written originally by...
Was it Catherine Lee Bates?
Exactly.
Yes,
boy,
yes.
You're on top of this whole
and
thing.
And Samuel A. Ward.
Yeah, but...
he wrote the music.
Yeah, she wrote this poem in 1893. He put the music on in 1903, and unfortunately he passed away before the song really took hold, you know, in 1910. That's when it was, I believe, released. And there were several people that took a go at writing a melody to the poem. And this poem was written, you know why the poem was written?
No.
Oh, okay, here we go, I'll tell you. She took a train trip from, I believe, New York to Colorado, and on her way back, going through the Rocky Mountains, and she was inspired, and she just took out, you know, a piece of paper and started writing this poem and reflecting the feeling that she was, you know, experiencing. And, you know, a lot of people think that maybe that should have been the national anthem because it's a striking melody and a striking lyric.
Yes, and it is a little more, how do I say?
Singer-friendly?
Yes, I would definitely say that. And it also has a certain kind of majesty and grandeur that is not jingoistic
absolutely.
In its expression.
Yeah.
Lonnie, I'd like to do one more number with you that will give me the opportunity to hear without your voice double tracked as it is on the
right
on the discs. Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer wrote a slew of hits in the 1940s, and one of them is a song that Harold Arlen called his tapeworm melody, because it was not in conventional 32-bar form. It just sort of went where he wanted it to go. And he later credited Johnny Mercer with making sense out of this melody that just was not easy for the average listener to get. And then when Johnny Mercer wrote this lyric, he made it into a complete journey that mirrored the music that made it, among other things, a hit song.
I just love the lyric to that song. You're the mate that fate had me created for. I think it's just a great song, and we did it slow, so that and in a very sensual way, because what I knew of Old Black Magic was the Keeley Smith and Louis Prima version, which was, you know, very up-tempo, fun, and, you know, and so...
And tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Yes, but it was tongue-in-cheek. But, you know, it was this up-tempo song.
Yes.
And when Herb and I recorded it on the first album that we did together, Anything Goes... we did it in a very sensual way and in a slower way with this pulse going on underneath it. And it was very interesting, but I'd like to try it in a different way with you, Michael.
Oh yes, well, let's do it. My great pleasure.
That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well. Those icy fingers up and down my spine. The same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. The same old tingle I feel inside. And then that elevator starts to glide. And down, down, down I go, round, round, round. I should stay away. What can I do? I hear your name, and I'm aflame. Aflame with a burning desire. Only your kiss can put out. The mate that fate had me created for, and every time your lips meet mine, I go down, 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 round, round, round in a spin, loving the spin I'm in under that old black magic called love.
Oh, Lonnie, that was a joy. That was a joy.
Well, it was my pleasure. I had a great time.
I had fun listening to it. It was beautiful.
Oh, good.
Just beautiful. Both of you.
I love accompanying. I love accompanying because it's that excitement of phrasing exactly with what the singer is doing.
But the singer is also listening to the music as well, and that's what's inspiring to start fooling around with phrasing.
Yes.
To respond. It's such a give and take.
Yes, it's great. Thank you for that.
I'm glad that
it exists so I can play it for the kids I'll never have in years to come.
That's not very optimistic.
That's all right. I have cats. And they love music too.
Play it for them.
Right. There's some songs that jazz musicians consider jazz standards, singers considered Great American Songbook standards, and the song that I keep going back to is one that was written by the brother of the great singer, Dick Hames, Bob Hames, and it's called That's All. Have you done that song much through the years, Herb?
No, I haven't, but it's a song that I happen to like, and I remember seeing Bobby Darin once at... when he was doing concerts, he was at the Macambo in Los Angeles, and he used to close his show with this song.
Oh.
And he's, I can only give you love, that's what, and he would do it fast. And the crowd is all that'll do, that's all. And the lights would go off, and he would leave.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
it was very dramatic. And Bobby was a really... Did you know Bobby?
No.
He was really a great artist. I mean, he really had something magical as well.
I love his work. He died at 37.
Yeah, 37. Unfortunately, he had a heart problem, and
yeah.
There was no way out. He just had...
Did you ever work with him?
No, I met him, but I admired him. You know, he was a good guy. He had an attitude. You know, he really knew what he wanted, and he got what he wanted. So he lived a life.
Well, let's do it for him as our final tune.
Let's do it for him.
That's all. Thank you. That's All, a very beautiful song, a beautiful melody. You played it beautifully, Herb.
Oh, thanks. It was fun.
Before we say goodbye, I want to acknowledge that both of you have been extraordinary in what you have given to so many by your mission of perpetuating the arts. Mm. I know it is very, very important to both of your souls, and there are so many people who are grateful to you for not only speaking about it, but really taking the initiative and doing something that has impacted so many souls.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure being with you. We enjoyed meeting you.
Our pleasure, definitely.
You know, we're certainly aware of, you know, your artistry and admire you very much.
Thank you. Absolutely. The pleasure is truly mine. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Song Travels with host Michael Feinstein and guests Herb Alpert and Lonnie Hall. Song Travels is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio and is recorded at Luz Muse Recording in Los Angeles, California, with post-production in the Elaine T. Freeman Suite at ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, associate producer Laura Hunsberger, recording engineers Jim McCurdy and Andrew Shire, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production manager Kathy Bradbury. The executive producer is Kobe Hennessy. The executive in charge is Linda O'Brien. Special thanks to Anya Grundman, director and executive producer of NPR Music. We love to hear from you. Our email address is songtravels@scetv.org. Our postal address is 1041 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. Song Travels is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. Additional support comes from NPR and NPR member stations. Support for NPR comes from NPR contributors, which include the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, and the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. This is NPR.